My name is Charlie Ravens. I'm the director of the STD program from Illinois. I'm also serve as the co-data manager for Region 5, which is the Midwest. And so I have a kind of a unique perspective of both running a program and looking at the data. And so what I want to talk to you today about is some efforts we've made in our region to improve the quality of our data, especially around quality and completeness. Like all regional infertility prevention projects, the goal of our projects are to reduce prevalence of chlamydia and resultant complications by screening and treating at-risk persons. So because we can't screen everybody for a number of reasons, it's important that we have good data to be able to make evidence-based decisions. And so, you know, having high quality and complete data is important for several reasons. One, which I left off the slide, is, you know, to even be able to describe the epidemic and the trends. You've seen a number of slides throughout this presentation about the trends. If we don't have good data, how can we describe the epidemic and make good decisions? It's especially important in deciding on what populations we should screen because we can't screen everybody. We need to have good data to be able to make program evaluation and, more importantly, do something with that data to continually improve the programs that we're working at. As most of us, we don't have enough resources, so we need the good data to be able to effectively allocate our resources. And as we've heard throughout the conference, because there are a number of health disparities, we really need good quality data to be able to define health disparities and then start to take action to reduce them. So one of the things about 2 or 3 years ago, we were really working on the whole issue of reducing screening in low-risk populations. And as we were looking at the data, we noticed that we had a big improvement in reducing the number of records where we didn't know the client age. So after we kind of did that, we said, I wonder if there's other demographic factors that have been reduced. So we decided to take a look at our data over some period of time to determine which data variables have we improved completeness, and then was that region-wide, was it just in a couple of states, and what were some of the probably best practices that led people to be able to improve their data, as well as identifying some of the barriers that prevented from people from collecting all the variables. So we took a look at our regional infertility prevention data from the five states or six states, and we looked at it, we compared 2002 to 2006, looking at demographic variables, and then we contacted the states with high completeness rates to see what they were doing that was working, as well as contacting the states with low rates. So what were the results? Well, when we compared 2002 to 2006, you can see that even in 2002, we had relatively very low rates of missing variables. We're only 0.4% for sex and 0.3% for age, primarily because most labs, because of the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Act, require those kinds of variables oftentimes in order to process the specimen. But as you can see, we had relatively high rates of missing data on race and ethnicity. And when you look at, you know, the percentages sound high, but when you look at the number of records, in 2002, we had over 128,000 records that were missing ethnicity and 82,000 records that were missing race. And then we looked at it in 2006, and you can see some significant decreases in the percent of unknown records. However, and I'm the glass is half full kind of person, we did make some big improvement. We still have a number of records, as you can see, over 91,000 records out of about half a million records, where we're still missing ethnicity and we're missing race. So we have, work has been going on, but we still have a long way to go. So the next thing was to say, okay, where in the region did we have improvement? So we looked at the six states, and as you can see, it really varied. Illinois had a huge improvement. We went from 6.8%, for example, in race to 0.6. Indiana actually went up. Michigan went down. And so there was really a variation. And so one of the commonalities of the two states where there was some significant either decreases or a sustained low rate was Illinois and Indiana, and Illinois and Ohio, and both of those states had active surveillance methods, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. And then when we looked at ethnicity, we saw similar trends. Illinois went from 11.2 to 0.6. Ohio, again, maintained a very low rate, and then it varied. So again, we were still concerned about the relatively high rate in a number of states. So when we contacted Illinois, which was pretty easy since I worked there, and I happened to know one of the things that we were doing, we've been concerned about the high rate of missing data elements for several years. So one of the things that we did was we created a report that we would send out to providers every month to get them to fill in the missing records. So this is sort of what the report looks like. And this is from every test that's done at our state lab, which whether we provide data for the IPP project as well as all the testing that's done at our state lab, which is about 190,000 tests a year. And so every provider who submitted a test, well, initially the first time we did this, we only did it for people who we provided testing for free, because we have about 5,000 providers that we actually, you know, they're not really eligible to get our services, but because we can provide testing at a low cost, we allow them to use our lab. So at first we said, let's just get the people that we're giving it to free, because we have a little bit of a clout, because we can, you know, kind of coerce them a little bit. So we create this report. It comes every month. We send this out to the providers. And when we first started doing this, you know, we had a huge number because we had a pretty high missing rate. And over time, what we found was people got tired of filling these out every month, so they ended up starting to fill out the lab requisition form. And so it's really helped cut down the rate. And then we send out a memo each month with that, with two sort of messages. The first highlighted message is sort of like all the altruistic reasons why you should fill out. It's a good thing. We need to have good, complete data. And then sort of like I would say the IRS approach is, you know, you need to do this, and if you don't, you might lose your free tests. So we have sort of found that you can be nice to people, but you also need to say, you know, if you're getting something for free, there is a cost. You need to do, you know, you need to get the results. And then after we did this for the first year or two and saw a really big improvement, we said, I wonder if people who are paying for the test, will we have any leverage? So we started doing the same kind of process for the people that pay for their test and said, you know, so we had to change our message a little bit about, again, you know, this is part of our grant and it's for good epidemiology, but we didn't have any kind of implied threat at all since they're paying. So we also, the other thing is it was very important, we had to create a database to be able to easily get that data in. So we created this data collection form, which the hardest part of the whole form was you had to enter in a 10-digit serial number. And about a year after we started doing this, because of a budget crisis, we lost all our clerical staff. So it became incumbent upon, it was my job to enter all these records in. And so we had, I had to do at least 500 records a month. And whenever you have to do the work, you kind of start really looking at the process. And one of the things I found was, first of all, to remember looking at a form and then enter 10 digits was not the easiest thing to do. And I would mess up and it would bring up the wrong record. And so it was, you know, a little bit troublesome. So I'll tell you about how we fixed that in a minute. And then the other thing is, as we build our data collection form, so once you enter the record, it brought in this record and it would throw the data in. We also built the system to be able to measure which records did we correct and which records we didn't, so that you're going to be able to evaluate how effective the system was. So as I said, I got a little bit busy. In addition to entering all these records, I had to sort the mail for our division. I said, there's got to be an easier way to do this. So I said, why can't we barcode these and gun them in, and then it would just automatically bring up the record. So we got a barcode reader, and they're pretty cheap. They're, I think, anywhere from $150 to $500. And as you can see, instead of having the serial number, it automatically prints out the barcode. We get these records, and you can gun in 10 at a row. And then all we have to do is very quickly enter these records. So it's relatively very easy to do this on a monthly basis. And so as an example of what we did was, as you can see, for example, with ethnicity, we started out with 5,700 records where ethnicity was missing. By sending these out, we were able to fix 92% of the ethnicity records, 91% of the race records, 88% of the date of birth, 93% with sex, and even zip code, which people think is very hard to get, we're able to improve 71%. So I think, you know, easy to show that having an aligned listed method in getting people to do this and then giving them feedback really improved our missing rate. And then we looked at, once we decided it worked for people that were getting it for free, we tried it out for people that were paying, and we found that they would also fill those out. And so you can see comparing both groups, both the payers and the non-payers, we're able to get the missing rate for race down to, you know, 0.3%, and payers down for 0.4%. Same thing with ethnicity. So we're able to show that, you know, by doing this process, we're able to significantly reduce the missing rates. Then we did an analysis, okay, you know, is it just STD clinics that are driving this? Well, in Illinois, STD clinics only account for about 14% of all reported cases. So we, you know, as you can see, family planning clinics are about 43% of our cases. STD clinics, at least, this is as far as testing, about 28%. But even across different provider types, we got almost every other provider type to end up really significantly reducing their missing data. In fact, one of the things we did is we looked at family planning clinics, and 76% of all our family planning clinics had zero missing data. So I think, you know, there's always a few that have some issues that account for most of it, but the majority of our providers have been really good after filling out these forms, deciding to either to initially fill out the forms correctly or correct them when we got them. And then we contacted Ohio, and they had a very similar record method where they sent out a letter on their missing. And this is kind of what the memo looked like. And then what they did was they would just have this, you can see on that where those red circles are, which is like they would have a nine, and they would ask the providers if there's a nine there to go ahead and fill in the missing information. That's one example we did. A second example was when we were working with the city of Chicago, they have some very large clinics, and they got a little bit frustrated about having to fill out those forms. And so we said, well, one of the things, and we knew that they had a computer system called Global where they actually entered in a client record. And so then we said, okay, instead of filling out those forms, we will send you a line list every month of all the missing data elements. They did a match with their Global system, and then would send that back to us, and we were able to significantly reduce the number of missing records. So, for example, out of this system, initially we had 7.3% where we didn't know ethnicity, and we got it down to 1.6% race, the same thing from 8.7 to 1.7, and even zip code, we went from 5.6 to 2.6%. So this is an example of how using an electronic match, which is easier than doing a paper thing, but what if it's available, can significantly help. And then one of the other benefits that we sort of learned over time is that not only did this help us to increase our infertility data, but by matching this with our incidence data, our case reporting data, which is different, by matching those two databases, we were able to increase the number of cases that we ended up counting as incidence and reporting to CDC as our total morbidity. And as you can see, it sort of varied by year and by percent. So we really varied from anywhere from 2 to 7%, we were able to increase the number of cases of chlamydia that we reported a year. And for gonorrhea, similar kind of effect, you know, lower number of cases because of lower prevalence. But you can see even gonorrhea just by doing a data match. And so one of the things that's also helped us is with our data that we send to CDC and that we count for incidence, because our infertility data was very good because we did, you know, the data quality, we're able to improve the data that we do in our case reporting by doing a data match. So it's really important to do data matches. And so as you can see, this is looking at our incidence data, not prevalence data. You know, we still have what I would say unacceptable rates. I think our percent of race unknown is 11.9% for race and 12% for ethnicity, but it's a lot better than it was initially. So in conclusion, I think it's important to conduct periodic quality assurance reviews and implement active follow-up. What we have found is voluntarily, and that's what we did for a number of years, asking people to improve their data. They have the best of intentions, but unless you send out a system where you really make people and say, you got to fix your data, you're not going to really get very high quality data unless you have an active system. The other thing is, most people are really willing to work with you. I think sometimes we have this attitude, you know, people are frustrated, they don't want to do this, and that's what we heard from some of the states that had very high rates. They said, no, they don't want to fill it out at the clinics, but we found that when we sent out these forms, we ended up getting the data. And so then my last conclusion is, you can use your data from your prevalence to also improve your incidence data. So these are some examples of doing continuous quality improvement to really reduce the rate of missing data elements so that we can make better decisions. So I want to thank our collaborators at healthcare education and training, our coordinators in all the states, our lab and testing staff, and specifically the IDPH and CDPH STD program staff. Thank you. So any questions? I'll put out my contact information. Okay, the question was, when we were comparing the 2 years, did we look at which clinics changed? We didn't actually do a clinic-by-clinic analysis. We did, one of the things, when you saw some of the states where they had actually an increase, part of that was caused by they added new clinics and the startup things in like that particular year. So I think probably a purer way we would have done it was to take a set of clinics that we reported in 2002 and 2006. But I think overall, which, you know, we did find a big improvement. So, you know, that's something we probably should look into. It went to the individual clinic, because we do provider codes that identify who submitted the specimen. We don't actually, not the actual individual physician, but the let's say it's a family planning clinic, that agency, and then they got those, and then somebody on staff fixed those. So the question was, you know, we're doing this with lab prevalence. Should we do this with people that are mandated case reporters? And I started thinking about that, and I think it's something worth trying. I think a little bit different is a lot of times the reporters say that, you know, they're very hurried, they don't have a lot of time. But I think we should try it and see. And I think most people, I think if you explain why you're trying to do it, and also the other value is give them feedback on their data. I think if you send that provider and say, look, you treated 50 people, here's some demographic data from the 50 people you treated, and by the way, you know, you're missing a lot of data, so how do you, you know, help you make better decisions in your practice? I think if you give people their data back, I think it would be helpful. But that's something that I think we're going to look into, because all of us nationally are trying to improve our performance about a data completeness on our incidence data also. So that's something I think we'll look into. Mark? You know, I don't know if we really looked at which providers weren't reporting, at least for that last piece. I think that's something we're going to have to do. And I think one of the things we're trying to do is more frequently look at our reporting data, and then either contact a local health department or somebody to say, especially because oftentimes it's one or two providers that account for most of those cases, and really work with them. So I think we might be out of time, but I'll be happy to stay around.
Well, we can take one more.
Okay. Go ahead. I believe that they go out in an envelope and they're double wrapped. And so it says, you know, there's a regular envelope, and then inside of it, there's another envelope that says confidential to only people, you know, who should be looking at this data. So, you know, that is a risk, because it does have, you know, they have to have the clinic names, that you can't just use a number. It would be very hard for them to look at. We usually just send it to the clinic site. I think sometimes we'll have in our database, we'll have a contact person. So, all right, thank you.